Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Elmer Dixon is a longtime activist involved in social change since the Black Power movement of the 60s. He was born in Chicago and at age 7 moved to Seattle, where his father relocated the family in search of a more promising life. Elmer grew up in the turbulent times of the Civil Rights Movement, living with his family in Seattle's Central District in the Madrona area. It was there that he and his siblings learned to respect people from all races and were taught by his parents to judge a person by their character, not by the color of their skin, a philosophy that was emphasized by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In 1965, he and his brothers, along with their parents, marched with Dr. King in a demonstration for the rights of poor and oppressed communities. After meeting Bobby Seale, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, in the spring of 1968, he co-founded the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. Elmer served as the chapter's deputy field marshal. The Seattle chapter organized police alert patrols, which were intended to monitor and halt police abuse, and the Children's Free Breakfast Program, free medical clinics, and the free food programs, among others. His earlier experiences in the party laid the foundation for Elmer's work in diversity and inclusion. Continuing his passion for social justice, Elmer has worked in the field of human rights, multiculturalism, and inclusion for the past 25 years, and now serves as the president of Executive Diversity Services. Elmer Dixon. Our other special guest is Dr. LaShonda L. Pittman, Assistant Professor, Department of American Ethnic Studies at the University of Washington. As an urban poverty ethnographer, Dr. Pittman's research focuses primarily on the coping experiences of socially marginalized women, including Black women living with HIV, AIDS, and low-income urban Black grandmothers caring for their grandchildren. She is currently focusing on three distinct but interrelated aspects of grandparent caregiving. Her forthcoming book, Coerced Mothering, Caregiving in African-American Grandmothers, examines the coercive forces that compel grandmothers to provide care under the harshest conditions and affiliated questions concerning individual coping responses, institutional and familiar barriers and resources. Dr. LaShonda L. Pittman. Now, this is the beginning of a short question and answer period. I believe the first.
Can you all hear me? For those people who aren't familiar with you and your work or familiar with the Black Panther Party here in Seattle, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the Black Panther Party and why the Black Panther Party versus other civil rights organizations at that time?
First of all, let me start by acknowledging my comrades, both alive and deceased. It's a little difficult for me to jump right into that question after seeing Chairman Fred murdered so brutally, and it just brings back a lot of vivid memories from that time. As the gentleman said, we grew up in a very turbulent time in the 60s, and the dichotomy of believing that police and firefighters were protectors of our community and seeing them brutally beat, shoot, and kill peaceful demonstrators drove many people, young people like myself, to join the Black Panther Party. And I will say that prior to the party, when my consciousness was awakened, because you know, we've been put to sleep in this country. We're still asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Back then it was Ozzie and Harriet. Today it's Kim Kardashian. And so when Stokely Carmichael came to town in 1967 and told us that the reason why black people were in such a dilemma was because that we hated the color of our skin and we hated ourselves, that was the initial spark that woke my awakened my consciousness. And so I became a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee here in Seattle. Later we formed the first high school black student union on the West Coast at Garfield that was followed by a group of us being asked to go to Franklin to help the brothers and sisters there organize a black student union. And it was on that occasion, a week later, that after we had taken over the school and had our demands met, myself, Aaron, Larry Gossett, several other people who had participated in the takeover of Franklin High School were arrested within the hour of Martin Luther King being assassinated. And we traveled to Oakland, or actually to San Francisco, to be a part of the West Coast Black Student Union Conference. And at that conference, we met Bobby Seale. And Bobby Seale was giving a speech about the death of little Bobby Hutton and invited us over to the funeral. And a group of us, when we went over to Oakland and we got off the Bay Bridge in Oakland, for those of you that know the layout in San Francisco and cross into the Bay Bridge, when we got off the bridge, we saw this black army of young black brothers and sisters that were organized against racial oppression and injustice. And that's what fired us up to join the Black Panther Party, and we became the first chapter outside of the state of California. So it was a direct response to all of the racism and hatred that we had seen growing up in our lives being perpetuated against black people. When we saw an organization that was going to stand up and be counted and do something and fight back. And that's what led me to join the Black Panther Party.
So I think the movie did a really great job of talking about how there were different chapters all over, sometimes very much interlinked with one another and sometimes not so much. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the Seattle chapter evolved over time and how it was similar and maybe not so similar to other chapters throughout the country.
Well, first of all, that's a misperception. All of the chapters across the country were linked in a common effort, common struggle, and a common identity and a common purpose. There was no disconnection. I could go to any city in the United States where there was a Black Panther Party and walk right in the door and be accepted as one of the comrades and walk right into a situation where I was surrounded by Panthers in the struggle. So we were all unified. the Seattle chapter, when we formed, we formed pretty rapidly, as did other chapters. As I said, we were the first chapter formed outside of the state of California. When Bobby left us here in Seattle after he had organized our chapter, he, along with several of the Panthers, including Aaron, moved east and started stopping in cities all across the country, including Chicago, and started lighting up these chapters. And these people, these brothers and sisters, were already ready to be organized. And we quickly learned that revolution was a lifelong struggle and was something that we knew that we were not going to abandon right away and that we weren't going to achieve our long-term objectives. In fact, most of us thought we would be dead before we were 21 years old. I was 17 years old at the time. And so we realized that we were in a protracted struggle. And so we had a lot of organizing to do in order to change the dynamic, to shift the dynamic in this country. So we were organized and we were together across the country. That's a misperception that we were not.
So another question that I have sort of related is, how connected was the Black Panther Party here to other civil rights organizations?
To be quite honest, we weren't connected to any civil rights organizations. We told it like it was, and, you know, we spoke truth, I think you heard one of the commentators in the film say that, you know, we're not going to lie our way down, lying down. We're not going to go lying down, sitting down, crawling, demonstrating, but we were going to, you know, push for armed struggle and armed revolution. I think people have a misconception about the free breakfast programs. You know, I heard applause about our programs, the survival programs, but the programs were called survival programs pending revolution. See, we weren't worried about just feeding kids to feed kids. You know, we knew that kids needed a hot breakfast before they went to school. But see, we learned, as a member of the party, when we joined the Black Panther Party, you had to own at least two weapons and 1,000 rounds of ammunition for each weapon. So our first posture was a defensive posture to defend ourselves and defend our community. And we knew that the racist power structure was not going to give us what we wanted, or it did give us, you know, given to our demands. You know, the 10-point program was about addressing the needs within our community. And so we had to read 2 hours a day and educate ourselves. You saw a brother in the film there holding the red book. You know, we read Mao Zedong. If we aligned with anybody, it was revolutionaries, people that were willing to die and willing to fight. We didn't align ourselves with civil rights organizations. So I won't lie about that and sugarcoat it, because we were about taking direct action, not standing around talking about it. And so when we analyzed the community, we learned that power is the ability to define phenomena and make it act in a desired manner. Emory talked about, you know, the sisters, you know, coming into the party offices with, you know, hungry babies. You know, people would come to us every day because they were in dire conditions, in dire situations. And when we saw that the young kids in our neighborhood were starving, we went about to feed them. When we saw that in King County, in the CD, the gentrified central area today, when we saw that small neighborhood had the second highest infant mortality rate in the whole state, because people could not get decent health care. We went out and organized a free medical clinic. But those programs were called survival programs pending revolution. They were not about feeding kids just for the soul of feeding kids, or passing out groceries just for the purpose of passing out groceries. It was to work with the community and work with people to stimulate revolution in our community, to fight back and throw off the yoke of oppression. That's what we were about.
So I'm wondering if you can speak to the experiences of the Black Panther Party and how it can inform the Black Lives Movement. Oh, thanks. What takeaways from the Black Panther Party experience can be used to inform what protesters are doing today?
That's a question I get a lot. And if it's one thing that I would say to Black Lives Matter and other organizations that are fighting oppression, and that is to never, ever give in on your principles, and that is to stick by your principles. You know, you heard... You heard someone in the film say that we were a racist terrorist organization. We knew and we know today who the racists and who the terrorists are. And so when someone says to the Black Lives Matter movement, well, all lives matter, stupid, we know that. But it's not you who are being brutalized and murdered and shot and killed. A 12-year-old boy go out into a playground with a toy gun and be shot down by a cop 2 seconds after they arrive on the scene. That wouldn't happen in Bellevue. It happened in a black community to a black child. So that's why when you say Black Lives Matter, we're talking about getting to the heart of the thing. And so stick by your principles. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. You know, with these fools running around here, Giuliani and the police association saying that Beyonce is perpetuating racism because she had the audacity to stand in front of 40 million people on national TV and salute the Black Panther Party. We know who the real racists are. Giuliani's a racist. Giuliani's a hypocrite. And so Black Lives Matter, all power to the people.
So last question, and then we'll open it up to the audience. We know that the Black Lives Matter movement was created by queer black women, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi, as a call to action for black people after 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was murdered and his killer George Zimmerman set free. Unlike civil rights organizations of old, the role of women and LGBTQ individuals are front and center. Can you talk about what this means for the movement today?
Well, you see, when you, again, when you watch the film and we talked about the role of women in the Black Panther Party, and you know, it, you know, Seattle, and I'll talk a little bit about, you know, what happened in Seattle. See, we never had any, distinguished any difference between role of women and men in the Black Panther Party. It didn't matter to us, you know, what sexual orientation you were. You know, what mattered was that you were a revolutionary and you were standing up for, you know, what was right. And, you know, while we may have struggled inside the party because some people may have tried to turn the clock back and many of those were probably agents anyway, you know, the thing is that, you know, what is right. You have to stand for what is right. And the fact that queer women are leading the struggle, I say right on, you know. you know, whoever has the audacity and the tenacity and the veracity, you know, to stand up to what is wrong, then I salute you then. All power to the people. You have to excuse me, you know, after at the point of where the film ended, you know, I'm like right in the... I'm reaching in my back pocket to see if my gun's back there, you know. I'm serious. Michael knows what I'm talking about. I just want to point out that sitting down here on the front row is my younger brother, Michael, who saved my life a couple of times. You know, you see the film, these pictures of me and my comrades standing on the Capitol stairs. What you don't know is that the day before those pictures were taken, we were headed down to the Capitol to march on the Capitol with our weapons, and somehow the authorities got wind that we were coming, and we had people everywhere. And Michael was a page. Anybody know what a page is? Or they, you know, they helped the legislators down in Olympia. So they thought he was a safe nigga. Excuse me, Michael. And and so Michael called us up and said they got a 50 caliber machine gun up on the Capitol, up on the dome. They got snipers everywhere. They're going to kill you if you come down here. And so we said, okay, we'll pick another day. And the very next day, you know, after they had put all their weapons away and drove home and sent the National Guard back, then we came down and caught them totally off guard. And so I thank my younger brother for that. he was an undercover Panther. And sitting right next to him is the one of the Japanese members of the Black Panther Party here in Seattle, Mike Tagawa. who was also one of the original founding members of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. See, we, right on, Michael, we had coalitions with, you talking about who we worked with? The Young Lords, AIM, the American Indian Movement, the Brown Berets. We had there was a group of old white folks running around calling themselves Gray Panthers. We organized with them, you know. Whoever was willing to pick up a gun and say, hell no, no more, that's who we organized with. Whoever was ready to not turn the other cheek, someone slapped my cheek, I was going to smack them back. Anybody who had that mentality, that's who we organized with. There's one up there. Guy's got a mic. Why don't we take him first?
Hello, my name is Dominique Smith. I'm actually a tourist that just stumbled upon this, so I'm pretty grateful to be able to be here and see this. The question I have came from a comment that you had earlier about how we're still asleep now as a people. And when I look at the documentary, I see that the Panthers use like printing presses and the media to dominate a society that was turned against them. Today, I can see like we're saturated with social media, reality TV, and things that can blind us from real issues that are going on. Actually attending school at Chicago, I've been around like the Black Lives Matter movement and other campaigns. And with the like Facebook and things like that, you get like this pool of people's different opinions, but nothing really concrete. And sometimes that can blot out the people that are actually on the street doing things. Even how the media portrays us on camera, calling us thugs or hoodlums when we're actually trying to do something positive in the same way that you guys did back in the day. So the question I have is, what would be some key characteristics or key points that we can pick up as youth that can help us dominate a world controlled by social media?
Keep it simple. We used to say educate to liberate, you know, and we just continued to get the true word out there, and we continued to work every day and do something. You saw in the Panther offices in the film, you know, it wasn't a job for us or in like a 9-to-5. It was 24 hours a day. Now, I know today as you organize and you have, you know, you have lives to live and you have families to feed, but at least in your heart and your mind, it's got to be 24 hours a day. And if you keep, you know, you just got to get your message out there and you got to be organized and have a program and do something. See, if you take all of the points out of the 10-point program, and one of those was we want an end to the robbery of the capitalists of our Black community. And so when we organized the breakfast program and we went into Safeway and we said, you reside here in this neighborhood and we have a breakfast program, so we want you to donate to the breakfast program. And Safeway said, we don't do that. And there were two Safeways that were bookends in the Black community. One was on 23rd and Union, and the other was on 23rd and Jackson. And we said, if you do not give to the breakfast program, then you got to get out of the neighborhood. And within 2 weeks, we ran them out of the neighborhood. And so you got to stop talking about it and do something. There was another grocery store right around the corner from that Safeway, right on 23rd and Union, run by a little Jewish guy by the name of Jack Richland. And I went into Jack's store and I said, Jack, we need some food for the breakfast program. You know what Jack said? Jack said, how much you need? I said, Jack, whatever you can give us. Jack was so supportive, and the neighborhood knew that he was, that he left that little tiny store and moved right up on the corner and opened Jack's Super Mini Market because he supported the community. That's defining phenomena and making it act in a desired manner. That's what you need to do.
Thank you.
Hey, my name's Calvin Sampson. My 18-year-old daughter is Alexandra. She's the one that told me about this. I'm so proud of her. This is a neat thing I'm seeing here. My uncle was city councilman for 38 years here in Seattle. His name is Sam Smith. My mom, both are passed away. Her name was Irma Jean Sampson. Worked for the Central Area Motivation Program. And I live this life every day. My only question is, what powers or how can I prove to my daughter that we're making an example? We're actually achieving our goal. What can I do as a father to prove that to her every single day of my life when I see kids like Tamir Rice murdered, Michael Brown murdered? I can go on and on. It just seems like a lot has not changed. So that is my question. Where is our power today and what I can do to benefit this for my daughter?
Number one is keep doing what you're doing. being a black father. I'll just give you one example. Last week, at 7 a.m., a group of 200 black men showed up at South Shore Middle School and stood there and welcomed all of those black kids and white kids coming into the classroom before they went to school and let them know that they mattered. So do something in your community and let people know that black men matter as well.
Hello, Mr. Dixon. First off, I want to say thank you very much for being here. I actually met your brother Aaron probably the first week I moved to Seattle. I want to let you know just how powerful the example you guys set back in the day. When I first came to Seattle back in 2000, it was a pretty cold place. I walk around and I'd be like, man, you know, I really don't want to move here. But one of the first things that my friend showed me was the Black Panther Wall that's out there in the Central District, right off of Jefferson, I believe it is. And I saw that, I knew that that there was a history of struggle, that there was a history of resistance and beauty, and that there was a place for me in Seattle. And I've been here for 15 years, and I still live in the CD. I ain't going nowhere. So thank you very much.
Right on.
Question I have for you is, you know, with Beyonce being on TV, you know, saluting the Black Panthers, it just kind of reinvigorated just how much misinformation there is about the Black Panthers. Here we are 50 years later. There's still so much confusion about what they stood for. I wanted to ask you why you think 50 years later, people still want to compare the Black Panther Party to the Ku Klux Klan. Thank you, sir.
Because that's a very good question, because the idea and the mentality of revolutionaries in this country, the idea of the revolution is so powerful. They were already scared to death of black men and women, as it were. But the fact that we could organize within our community and make a difference and a solid change and people would follow that lead was overwhelmingly dangerous to them and their status quo. I lecture in Finland and in Scandinavia, and when I walk into communities in Europe, the first thing they want to know is about how the Black Panther Party organized. And they know the truth about the Black Panther Party over there. Over here, the whole concept of the Black Panther Party has been smothered. They've tried to hide our identity and lie about it. You said compared to the Ku Klux Klan, that Ku Klux Klan. It's interesting that you say that. I went to a college campus here, the Seattle Art Academy, which over there near the waterfront, this Art Institute, to speak to a class over there. In fact, I was invited by a white professor who used to babysit Panther kids when she was a little girl. And she obviously knew the truth about the Black Panther Party. Her parents raised her that way. And when I went to the school, two students met me at the door, one of them black, one of them white. And the young black student said to me, this is just about 5 years ago, the young black student said to me, are you the Panther leader that's coming to speak to our class? And I said, yes. He said, what was the Black Panther Party? He said, was that like the black KKK? Now, that's deliberate. That's a deliberate misinterpretation. That's not an accident that young black people, a young black man would have that idea of the Black Panther Party. They've planted that idea to keep black people and white people and red people and brown people and yellow people separate. Because we were building a revolutionary coalition. What Fran Hampton said, we need white power for white people and yellow power for yellow people and red power for red people and brown power for brown people and black power for black people. He said, what we need is a rainbow coalition. That was not Jesse Jackson who coined that phrase. That was Fred Hampton, a member of the Black Panther Party. Because we had a multicultural philosophy back then. And what is needed today is that same type of approach. And so while, you know, we may organize within our communities, we still need to organize as a broad coalition to fight this universal racism where the wealth in this country is controlled by less 1/10 of 1% of the wealthy control the wealth of the world and then this country. And that's where the oppression comes from, and we need to stand together and fight against that.
Hi, thank you very much for coming and sharing your story with us. I'm originally from Chicago, and one of my uncles actually was a Black Panther in Chicago. And, you know, I've been watching the Black Lives Matter organization and also just looking at the video. My question is, when you were in the Black Panthers movement, how did you guys deal with policing the community, or did you do that? Because obviously we have real crime problems and what have you in many of our communities. Did you deal with self-policing, and do you recommend that to the people, the current movement that is going on?
Well, I could go a long while on that, on self-policing. Let me say that we, while we patrolled the police to get out of our neighborhood, we also were, in a sense, self-policing the neighborhood. There used to be a sandwich shop around the corner from Garfield High School called Bloomers. And you remember Bloomers. And the Gunther brothers, was that their name? Gunther was one of them. And they were, all the time while I was going in there and getting my sandwiches when I was in high school, I didn't know they were selling drugs right out the side door. You know, they were selling drugs to the kids in the high school. And you would think that the cops would know this and would shut it down, but they let it stay there because at that time, part of Hoover's plan was to infiltrate, let drugs flow into the Black community to destroy Black people. Do you think that gangs came about because we just said, ooh, let's start coming together and kill each other? You know, that was a planned action on the part of this system and this government to annihilate young Black and brown kids. And so we went up to Bloomers and kicked them out of the neighborhood and shut them down. So we self-policed. When sisters would come, we, you know, where the People's Wall, brother was talking about the People's Wall is what the name of it is, on 20th and Spruce, where our office was. Yeah, they tried to attack that several times, but that's another story for another day. But when sisters would come up to our office off of the Stroh, and Yesler used to have these red lights going up Yesler because it was the red light district, and down on 14th, where there's a school now, it was called the Hostro. And when sisters had enough of their pimps and they wanted to get off the block, now we didn't go out and just say no more pimping in the neighborhood. You know, that was not our role. But if sisters came to us and said, I want to get away from my pimp, then we would go to the pimp and say, you got to let her go. So we did a brand of self-policing. And I think we can police ourselves with, at least to a certain extent, if we're organized. We can stop these things within our community, but we have to stand together in order to do it.
Hello, my name is Jonathan Gooden. I want to thank you for coming out, and this documentary was amazing. I'm a relatively new resident to Seattle from South Central LA. Growing up without a father and finding my way throughout life, I wanted to know from you, with all the notable civil rights leaders that I have as examples, they're dead. They were either killed or had some type of hardship in their life that led them to the grave at an early age. I wanted to know, what was your realistic transition from a racially charged time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and when the Panthers kind of fell out of the spotlight, what was the reality for you transitioning to be an adult? And what did you have to do from having the courageous mindset that you did to taking care of responsibility and being the man that you are today?
That's a good question, brother, but there was a journey. I don't know if I can answer that in a brief statement. You know, to come from a point when we knew that we would be dead within a matter of months or a year, to moving on with your life after you saw the party destroyed from the actions of J. Edgar Hoover and things that went on internally in the party. It was a hard transition. But I realized that, you know, life goes on and you have to get on with your life. And at the same time, that doesn't mean that you can't make a difference. And so I ended up through a variety of channels, and, you'll have to read the story in my book because it's going to be in there. But a variety of channels, the one thing, and I said this earlier, the one thing that kept me focused and kept me moving forward was staying true to my principles, staying true to my principles, and staying true to the fact that I needed to be a change agent in whatever form or fashion that I took. And all I can say now is that, you know, 50 years ago, 45 years ago, when we armed ourselves with guns to defend ourselves and we were trying to tell white folks how to be inclusive, now as a diversity consultant, they pay me to tell them that. They do. It's the truth. So I continue on, but I continue on at a different level, just in a different way. But we have to adapt. And if you don't adapt, you get left behind. And the reality was that the violence that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI through COINTELPRO and the various agents that infiltrated the party, you know, I don't know how this fool could sit up on this screen and in that movie. I don't even know how that. I turned to Michael when I saw him up there and said, how's that sucker still alive? I'm talking about the Fred Hampton's bodyguard who directed the FBI into his apartment. I really don't know. But, you know, to transition, you have to transition from that and move to a place where you can still be viable, where you can still make a difference. And so it was a long transition. It wasn't overnight. It wasn't, some sudden awakening. You know, when I driving down the street and the cop car goes by, I still cringe and look in the mirror and see if he's flipping around. I know that he's not going to flip around, but I just look anyway, because we were so programmed to be conscious of our livelihood and to be aware that we were in danger 24/7. So it's been a difficult transition. I'm still shell-shocked by it. I can sit down here like I did tonight and see the shorter version, because I've seen the full version, and I have it end right there where Fred was murdered. It just sent me right back there in an instant. And so I'm still shell-shocked by it. I know my comrades are still shell-shocked by it. But we have to move on with our lives, and we have to make a difference. And that's what I try to do every day, is live my life intentionally and try to make a difference every single day.
So I've been informed that we have 10 minutes. So if we could get more to the question, not much commentary, so that we can get through everybody in the next 10 minutes. Thank you.
I'm not going to say my name because COINTELPRO is real, but I'm part of Seattle Black Book Club, and we're carrying on the principles of the Black Panther Party. And two of the issues that we are faced with in black organizing is, one, COINTELPRO, and just knowing that the state is always watching and trying to stop, especially today, a lot of this stuff is done over social media, and we've done actions and stuff, and we've not used social media at all, trying to have good security culture, but then it also compromises because then not enough, the word doesn't get out. So I'm wondering how you guys dealt with COINTELPRO. And the other question I have is also another issue we deal with, is like dealing with internalized oppression amongst our own people, and when we're organizing, when that comes out in that conflict, and how can we make, and another issue is like, how do we know sometimes a conflict arises? Well, is this a plant trying to break up our whole group, or is this a real conflict? And so, like, how did you guys address conflict within your group and make sure it didn't break up your group?
That's a good question. Well, let me see if I can answer that as simply as possible. We concentrated, we studied every day. It was mandatory that we read 2 hours a day and study every day. And some of the revolutionary principles that we learned every day when we studied Mao Zedong and the Little Red Book, one of the things that stands out today in my mind still today is criticism and self-criticism. We learn to embrace criticism. We learn to self-criticize ourselves to make sure that we were staying true to our principles, and that allowed us to talk through challenges and issues whenever they came up or whenever they arose. And the other thing that allowed us to work through those challenges and those issues was that we knew why we were organized. We knew what the end goal was, and we knew that it was a long, protracted struggle and that we may have challenges along the way, but we never, in fact, held things, at least for the most part, within our organization, within our chapter, held things against one another. You know, if someone violated the rules and the principles of the Black Panther Party, that was another story. But if you stayed to the principles and stayed to the rules, and we knew we were going after the same thing, then there was no problem with criticism or self-criticism. We could talk those things through. So you need to identify a structure, identify a way that you're going to deal with issues when they come up, and stick to your principles and stick to your rules and be honest with yourselves, because everything isn't going to be smooth as you organize and as you fight and as you struggle. I'm the wrong person to be asking about social media. I have to have my grandson dial up my phone sometime. But I know that it's a tool that you can use to organize. But you have to be prepared to deal with the consequences of it. Because for every action, there's a reaction. And so you need to be prepared for that.
Well, on a lighter note, I'm going to say I became part of the party because the word was they had all these handsome men there.
Stop that.
And once becoming part of it, I came home and I told my mom that I wanted to be part of it. She was already wearing her black tam. And but what really focused on my mind is how we did things as far as the breakfast program and feeding them children. But what I have, my question tonight is, how do I, as a black woman, approach some of these young black men that are out here sagging and not aware of, you know, the political affront that's coming upon them? And how do we, you know, as women, start telling these young black men, or do we even approach them, or is there some guide that we can use to help? Because it's getting really dangerous out here.
And I'm not going to sit up here and pretend that I have all the answers, because I don't. I think that the main thing that is missing out of these young black children's lives is the fact that they don't believe that they matter. They don't have an identity other than one that's been created for them, and so they respond to the conditions in which they live. And they need to learn that they matter, that they've got an identity, that they have a purpose beyond, you know, the sagging pants and the music or whatever, that they have a purpose, that they matter. I was at Garfield on MLK Day, and a young mother had brought her son to hear me speak and talk to the group. And she brought the young man up to introduce him to me after the thing was over. And I looked at him, and I looked in his eyes, and I told him, I said, you matter. You know, you matter. You belong. You are somebody. And you could see that, you know, that had some effect on him. And so if you even get one of these kids, and if you can get through to them that they matter, that they have purpose, then you're doing your job. You know, I think I may have already said it, each one teach one, you know, grab one and teach them.
Yeah, my name's Rob Drury. I'm from this area. Wanted to thank both of you for focusing this discussion at this time, because I do have a question based on the observation that the the United States, at least, seems to be in the midst of an epidemic of madness in terms of political reality at this time. And we're facing, of course, you know, dangerous possibilities if clowns or fools or other people are elected. And it seems like it is a possibility. But it's been a very long time since I had a copy of the 10-point program, like a very long time. But I do remember reading it, and at least one of the candidates that's running seems to have a platform rather similar. His name is Bernie Sanders, and I wonder if you could comment on whether you think there's any purpose or point to electoral politics and supporting someone like Bernie, because there's it isn't a very hopeful scenario. Thank you for your thoughts on that.
Okay, well, let me be blunt. You know, I don't have any faith in the political system in the United States. I wasn't one of those folks that jumped on the bandwagon and said that everything's fine now when Obama was elected, because the powers that be in this country aren't going to let that happen. Didn't let it happen. It doesn't matter if Bernie Sanders gets in there. They're not going to let it happen when Bernie gets in there. I think we need to organize within our own communities and change the dynamic in our communities. It's going to happen in a grassroots outside of the political system. That's where the change is going to happen, because the political system, excuse my language, everybody, a spoiler alert, is fucked up.
Right. So we are almost out of time, and I wanted to turn the mics back over to Dr. Pittman, and Elmer's been holding it down all night, just for closing remarks, and then we'll just check in about wrapping up the program. So just closing remarks from both of our presenters.
Wow. I didn't expect that. So, you know, I think there's just a lot of synergy here, and a lot of similar ideas. I couldn't agree more with Elmer that it's going to have to come from us. You know, and I'm saying that also being inside of a particular institution, in the academy, right? But what the bio that didn't get read didn't talk about the community work that I do, and I've only been in Seattle for 2.5 years. So I think that if it's something you're committed to, it's something you're committed to, and it's something you're going to find a way to make a difference around. And I think it's about figuring out what your issue is. My issue is urban poverty. My issue is intergenerational families, bringing together two of the most vulnerable groups in our community, elders and children, in poverty, with no public support, right? And too often, no community and family support, because Big Mama got it. Well, Big Mama don't, right? Big Mama's dying from literally carrying these burdens. And I just feel like it's so easy for our generation, Generation X, Generation Y, to think somebody else got it. We got to have it. You know, when I was in college, I tell my students this all the time. I was involved in protest. I had to get a job before I could tell them that. But I think if it's something you want to get involved in, it's figuring out what that passion is and finding an inroad there and work with that issue. You know, I'm speaking at the state capitol in the morning. You know, it's like setting up health disparity clinics for intergenerational families here in Seattle, and this isn't even my home. So I just feel like it can be done, and it's figuring out ways to do that and making the commitment to doing it. Yeah.
I will just echo that sentiment. If you're waiting for a mass movement to happen, it ain't going to happen. You know, one of our other philosophies was do it in twos and threes, you know, because you can make a difference. You don't need 10,000 people to do it. So just go out there and do it. All power to the people.
We have some very enthusiastic people in the audience. Can you join us in thanking Dr. Pittman and Elmer Dixon?
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.